Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Danny Parkinson. We've decided to bring John Hammer on for a supplemental podcast. A lot of you probably heard his Mormon Stories podcast. And he, after that interview, he was feeling like he talked a lot about his religious experience, but really only touched upon his gay experience. And that's true. He didn't really get into much about that. And so we're just going to do another episode to sort of go along with that. But it'll be me interviewing him this time instead of John DeLynn. And it'll really only be posted on the Gay Mormon Stories. So, good day, John. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Great to be here.
Thanks. We happen to be recording on the 4th of July, so now you guys are going to know how long it takes me to get these up, because you probably won't hear it for a while. but hopefully we'll get it soon, since it is accompanying his other one. So, John, you, if I'm remembering well about the podcast, your interview with John, you touched a little bit about your teen and young adult years, but let's just go back a little bit to that and kind of talk about your adolescence. How old are you when you sort of started to wonder or have experiences that were relevant to being a gay person?
Well, it probably goes all the way back, I should think. You know, I was born in 1970. And so my growing up time period is the 70s and 80s. And that was the era, as people will remember if they're as old as me or older, that this wasn't, there wasn't a lot of visibility of the gay people in any of the mainstream media, in TV or movies. There was more actually happening than I was ever aware of. So even the, you know, for what, so what there actually was in TV and movies, I was somehow pristinely unaware of it and really had never seen almost any depictions of gay people in media. And I had no access to, you know, any kind of role models, having met anyone or any other thing. No, never met any openly gay person in all of my childhood. And so, you know, so I would have identified all the way back, you know, to when you just are having any kind of, you know, feelings like, or whatever, any kind of interest, even, you know, pre, you know, when you're a child, with, you know, your best friends. And so, I mean, I remember, you know, I don't know, fooling around with, you know, best friends when I was as young as 8 or 9 or something like that. Nothing, you know, more than just the being excited about maybe being, you know, naked during a sleepover or something like that. You know, and then, but then, you know, definitely by junior high, I realized, you know, was, you know, aware that, I was attracted to, you know, my male friends, or I was attracted to the other, to, you know, boys in the locker room, you know, during gym, but without, you know, having then have that, there was no, by there being no gay model or gay identity or anything available to be kind of to fixate on or be aware of or to put those pieces together, I didn't then identify that as meaning, oh, that means I'm gay. I didn't. So and so I, and actually all through then my teenage years, I just simply didn't focus on, you know, dating or any other thing at all. And as a Mormon kid growing up, you're not supposed to be sexual anyway. And so, to, you know, I was just a good kid. I didn't do anything. I didn't, you know, I had, you know, a couple, nominal girlfriends, more or less, just for the purposes of when we would go on a date to a big dance. And I think that all of my entire teenage years, I kissed one girl once, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So essentially,
Were you getting any shameful ideas about your sexuality or about sexuality in general or about masturbation or anything that was sort of impacting your
oh yeah, so then I
development?
definitely, when I was 12 and 13, I think that it's, I don't know, it's probably a universal, not just for gay Mormon youth,
Oh,
but
yeah.
I think it's probably a universal Mormon experience that you know, there is a, you know, a teaching and condemnation about masturbation, which people are unable to live, I think, by
Yeah.
and large. And so yeah, I definitely, as of a like when I was a 12-year-old and when I was up to about 13-year-old, struggled with that, felt that you know, agreed or felt that masturbating was wrong and was, you know, something that I even remember making kind of there was a temple trip the very first time we lived again. And again, this was a different time experience. So I grew up in Minnesota. Minnesota was very far away from any Mormon temples at the in the time period. And we, as a family, went on a big long road trip, went to Washington, D.C., where I was like, I think I would have been 12. And so this was the first time that I had the capacity to enter a temple, the Washington, D.C. temple, and do baptisms for the dead. And so the whole, you know, like trip, you know, and going to Florida all the way through this long thing that we did as a road trip or whatever, you know, I was, you know, as having this kind of deal or struggle. I remember, you know, commitment trying to make with God of to not, you know, okay, I'm not going to, I won't masturbate. I'll be pure, you know, in this amount of time to, you know, before we go into the temple and this kind of thing. And so I remember that as being just a big struggle. By the time I would have been 14, then I had ceased to, I'd become a kind of a doubting teenager, and I had ceased to have any struggles with, I mean, I didn't think that that was it was a big deal anymore.
So you let go of the belief already by 14 that it was a problem.
That was anything that was making me, I didn't feel like that was sinful, so.
So you weren't going to your bishop with it, or you never.
Oh no, I never went with
Okay.
my bishop with anything.
But meanwhile, even though you were okay, you felt okay about that element of your sexuality, you still were being a good Mormon boy, and you weren't thinking even that much about sex in general. You didn't have specific sexual fantasies about boys, apparently, or not so much, at least, that it was making you wonder
Well,
about your
so
orientation.
what I was doing, so what I would do, so, you know, not having any models of, you know, of gay couples or anything like that, the model that I turned to as a well-read teenager who did a lot of study of classical history and reading of Old Testament Bible, so this kind of thing, the model for me is the model described then in, or the, you know, the Old Testament, the Bible, you know, David and Jonathan. So the love that is had between King David and Jonathan, the son of King Saul, where their love, their friendship, you know, is described as being, you know, so much superseding the love that, let's say, either one of them would have been able to have with their girlfriend or their wife, right? And so that classical model that I think has been, you know, gay people throughout history have kind of, you know, looked to that model of, you know, male-male friendship that may or may not be sexual, but is a kind of a love that is a superior love, or at least is literally viewed as superior. So there's all kinds of models like that throughout history. So the Roman ideal friendship, the model of amicitia, how you can have this friendship again between two men that is, you know, that supersedes things like what we even would consider the kind of love that you might have that a man and a wife have, which is at best carnal love, right? So this is like this carnal, physical, inferior thing to the kind of just pure, incredible spiritual friendship that you know, perfect equals can have. And so those were the kind of the how I probably was able to channel that, and then simultaneously, what I then was doing in the last my later teenage years was forming just an intense, insane crush on my best friend, who was a straight guy, but who I was had fallen in love with, right?
Yeah, that sounds like sort of probably a common thing to happen to a Yenge boy who's suppressing it. And I had that. I had sort of a. I did go to the Bible, but I read a separate piece when I was in high school, and that was super. That just really resonated with me for reasons that I didn't fully get at the time, and I. So that just made me think. Oh, well, I need to. I sort of added it to this sort of fantasy I had about Ivy League schools and New England. And so I thought, so I just, that made me want to go there. So I sort of sublimated into a place, a location, an educational institution where I
Oh,
was
you're
really
like
just kind of
looking
wanted the
forward to
male
going to like
body.
an all boys school and
Well,
that kind of
not
thing.
even, yeah, I just thought, well, it's, I just sort of romanticized the situation that was described there, and so I sort of wanted something like that, and so I sort of adopted all of it, even though it was the part I probably really wanted was the intense bond. But anyway.
Yeah, so that's like the fantasy. So the fantasy that I were then having, and when I'm 16 or so, is I could see by then, even though I'm a doubting teenager in terms of Mormonism's truth claims, I was still a very active member, and so I was able to see, well, this is actually a human system like any other, and it's actually extremely manipulatable. And so I was able very, very easily and readily to go to, when I was 16, I was able to, I had changed my mind. I had been Deacons Quorum President. I hadn't been Teachers Quorum President because I was fed up with the whole thing. And when I was 13 and 14, but then by, or 14 and 15, when I turned 16, then I gave some talks. I smiled a lot. And so it took all of 2 weeks of planning and an execution to be called to be the priest leader, right?
Okay.
And so I, so because how does it work? So people, are moved by the spirit to call people, and so they're moved by when you were they're getting these emotional social cues, and so they got that by being, smiling and and speaking and talking and that kind of thing. And so then, so they didn't even, I didn't actually even have to plant the idea. It just happened. And so then what I did was I immediately, called, this friend who I had a crush on to be my counselor. And then,
Okay.
a couple months later, I did the very same thing in seminary. I got called to be seminary president and called him to be my counselor,
The
right? And so
same
I had this
guy.
kind of fantasy that in the future, then, we would live in a war and I'd be bishop and I'd call him to be my counselor,
Yeah.
and
I
that's
was
just
thinking
how
this
we do it.
wasn't this, you weren't even seeing this as a sexual thing. You were just,
Right.
and
So
it wasn't even manipulative. You were simply taking what you had and looking at a way to enjoy it, I guess. I mean, as to make it pleasant for you,
well, yeah, this
and
was
people do
persistent and
that consciously or unconsciously,
self-planned.
right?
And then in this case, I mean, I wasn't manipulating. I mean, I wouldn't say I was manipulating him. I was part of it. We were part of a system. I saw how the system operated. I had particular ends, and then as a result, I mean, then I, part of the way you get called too is that you're willing to take on responsibilities, and so you'd have to do some work. So anyway, so I did those things. But yeah,
Yeah. Well,
I mean,
that.
no, it's not sexual. We obviously weren't doing anything. I mean, there wasn't anything like that. I mean, he's a friend of mine. We were actually good friends, and he was straight, and that was just the way it was,
Yeah. No, I can totally relate to. I mean, I didn't do that, but I sure would have if I'd been given the opportunity, that's for sure. Okay. And so that was sort of kind of where you were at that got you to BYU. I mean,
that's exactly why I went to BYU. So I didn't have to go to BYU at all. I was, my parents didn't care, and so they were very, my parents were very, had a great ability or willingness to let their kids go on the path that the kids themselves chose, And so parents are just have been intensely supportive always of all their kids, I think, especially me. I felt very supported by them and up to right now. I mean, I just have a great relationship with them. But they wouldn't have minded either way. They didn't say, oh, you must go to BYU or anything like that. I was the mo my most likely scenario growing up in Minneapolis that I otherwise would have taken is what my brother ended up doing, which is to go to Madison, the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is another great school. And there's a reciprocal relationship between Wisconsin and Minnesota. So you can go to an out-of-state school but pay in-state tuition. And so that way you get far enough away from home, you're at a great college town, you're at a great university, big university, but you aren't immediately. If I went to the University of Minnesota, I was gonna, I would be living 20 minutes away from my parents' suburb, right? And so it would have been too close, and there wouldn't have been any legitimate reason to go and spend the money to have a dorm room or to pay money to live in your own apartment, which you should do, or I would prefer to have done, and I think it's a good thing for people to be able to do to go off and be able to live on your own. And I had had the experience myself. I had been a counselor at a summer camp, a Boy Scout camp in northern Minnesota, 2 months out of the year for when I was 15, 16, and 17. And so I had had already a bunch of experience kind of having my own, I mean, living on my own. And that had already been, I think I'd already had that as a wonderful experience. And so I definitely didn't want to go to college right where I was. But anyway, so in terms of my friend, though, his parents were quite of a different thought on that. And they more or less told him they were very well off and they would pay his entire way through college and everything else, but he could go to BYU or that he could go and they do that paying for it, or he could go anywhere else he wanted to and pay for it himself. So obliged to go to BYU. And since I knew he was had to go to BYU, so I'm like, okay, well, I'll just go to BYU. So that's why I went, you know.
So really, your friend was a big reason for you going there.
That and just being lazy. So then if I, so I didn't have to apply for a whole lot of schools, right? So that's a lot. So I applied for three or four schools, and I didn't have to go through this whole long rigmarole. I went to BYU, and I got a couple scholarships too for academics and art, and so it ended up being very inexpensive. And again, because of the way BYU at the time had this crazy policy of accepting AP exams as massive, they give you massive amounts of credit hours for them. And so when I found that out as a high school student that you could get, if you got a 3 on an AP exam, they gave you 12 credit hours. So I just took every AP exam that I might even marginally know anything about. I took the European history exam, even though I'd never had even had European history in high school, and I knew enough about it just as a learned whatever a teenager that I got a 3. Well, 3 was enough to get 12 credit hours in BYU. So I came into BYU with 24 credit hours of history in a 32 credit hour major. And I came in as a in terms of credit hours as a sophomore. So that's why when I got there, after having been there 1 year, even though after a year I had decided that this place was not for me and that I didn't care for the society at all and I'd prefer not to be there. I was only 2 years away from graduating from BYU at that point. That's a decision to knuckle under, plow through, and stay there. Because if I would have transferred at that point to Madison, I would have had another 4 years of undergraduate time instead of two.
Now let me ask you about this friendship. You went with your friend there. Did you go, were you roommates in the dorms? I mean,
So, I was 1 grade older than him. We're about 6 months different in age. So he's a church friend. He was in my high school, but he was also not in my grade. So I went out there before him. And so I spent the first year we away, and that was the year then that so I lived in the dorms, lived in Shipman Hall, and Helaman Halls was the male honors dorm at the time. And so then
Love
all the friends and everybody that I made that first year, with just two exceptions, they all went to the MTC, all the male friends, they all went to the MTC and were gone. And so then I had, and so then the next year I had, was like almost like a second freshman year for me in terms of the dorm experience, because I had a brand new swash of all brand new students. And that included, my friend who then came out then to BYU. And we had a great first half of the year. We were doing all kinds of, the kind of things we'd done together anyway. And we even went, we were on the student review together, the newspaper, and that kind of thing. But then in the kind of the second semester, the lead up to when he would go to the MTC and go on his mission, I was starting to have like some very serious, emotional. I was really starting to become very personally upset that this was going to happen. So as a result, I was doing like the kind of thing that you subconsciously do, where you are doing subconscious distancing things, or you're just doing sabotaging things so that you're preparing kind of yourself for what's coming. So that I would say that our second semester there wasn't as good, and that, but it was not in any way to his fault. It's because I'm kind of working through this personal crisis and this personal problem. And then when he then that summer went to the MTC, then I was just devastated, and so then I, at that point, even though I had done all that distancing and all that preparation, I was still, this was the puppy love crush of my, my youth, where I'd been
So
best
you
friend.
had done sort of created conflicts and just created some distance just by getting bothered by more things.
And probably.
Which can also happen when you actually live with someone, even though you might have already been friends. So part of that also can just occur with anybody, even if you're not in love with the person, right?
But in this case, I'm sure it was. In my reinterpretation, or my memory of it now, is that it's probably deliberate on my part, because of wanting to, be prepared for when this break was going to happen, but while simultaneously fighting for it not to happen. And so, one of the things that was happening is probably arguing strongly with about truth claims against Mormon truth claims, with the goal of, getting him to not go on a Mormon mission, right? So.
So that naturally is going to create some conflict, I suppose. And so just, I'm just to tie that up a little bit, was the 2 years that he was gone sort of enough for you? And I assume you kind of came out during that time and actually finished BYU. So that sort of just gave you the chance to kind of grow up and move on, or did that sort of resolve that issue?
So, I mean, what I did with him, therefore, was very unfair to him in retrospect, and I didn't know what I was doing. But anyway, obviously, that wasn't what, we were friends, and from his perspective, that's what we, should have been. But I obviously had it all charged up with, being a person who is a not out gay man, who is, doesn't understand what's going on, doesn't understand his own emotions and that kind of thing. And so, 2 years later, when he came back, I was already out. I came out to him. I explained it. It was, he understood. It wasn't, anyway, all of the different conflicts and the different things that we had, it was not that w it any conflicts we would have had. It was based on, this information that we weren't either of us aware of,
Yeah. Well, no, I had a similar experience. I had a, even more than one. I mean, I throughout my life, it was kind of a repeating pattern that I wanted my friends to be much closer than they were really available to be. And so even whether I did or didn't sexualize it, kind of depending on where I was at in life, I certainly wanted this intense, emotional, committed friendship, right? And so, yeah, that led to problems in the friendship because they just weren't there. I mean, they were super friends and they were best friends and amazing friends, but they just could never, give this commitment to me that I was kind of desiring, right? Even though I wasn't consciously wanting to create a sexual relationship, I was really wanting to have a committed bond, right? And a long-term bond and a reliable bond that wasn't distracted by other things like their girlfriends, right? So,
I think exactly as you describe it. That is exactly what I would describe this
Yeah.
experience.
Okay. So you talked, I think that was the part you talked the best about it in the other podcast was the BYU experience, and that you did come out and you were, comparatively open given the climate there.
Yes.
It's kind of surprisingly open because that was risky to do. Do you think there's any experiences that you likely left out of the other podcast that we should talk about of your college years?
I think I mean, like you say, I kind of described a lot of that. What I could say about it is that the experience then that I did have by being in this super persecuted minority, which is the gay community in Utah Valley, Utah, in 1993 or something, 92, I guess, 91, 92. And so as a result of that, that community was under enormous pressure, but it was also and it was in a lot of pain, but it was also something that it was a real huge shared experience. So when you're going through hardship together with a group, you are really connected into that group. And so there was a lot of, there was a really intense and powerful, sense of community among the small group of friends that I had there in the, in kind of support group and just the hanging out group and partying or whatever the other thing we were doing group. And so then when I did move then from there to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where Ann Arbor was just about as progressive as you could be for
Right.
gay people in 1992, where where my other friends in graduate school, when I told told people that I was gay, they were that's like, well, that's fine, whatever. That's no
Yeah.
deal, it's a completely different environment. And so then what I looked for immediately when I went to Ann Arbor was I went to the Episcopalian Church had a had something that looks like it was like a support group, which is the kind of thing that I'd known where people would go to have a support discussion group. But it was so completely different and alien because that wasn't the core of the community in Ann Arbor. The core were just people who were gay and had were pretty relatively fine with it, and then were just the main dance club in Ann Arbor on Tuesdays and Fridays is a gay club. And so and so that would be the community was happening way more just at the dance club every Friday
Yeah.
than at any kind of support group or something. So
So it didn't feel quite as tight-knit and unified as this sort of
yeah, I wasn't
being the
anywhere near
oppressed
as
minority,
didn't
which
like it
you didn't
as
like it
much.
as much.
I mean, I liked obviously you, of course it was better to be in a place that was had taller. I in other words, I liked the tolerant society. What I didn't like was the I didn't like the gay community as much as I liked the other one. So
Yeah.
that existed in the wake of the intolerant society.
Yeah. Well, there is something very, community forming about being under siege.
Yeah.
And so in a way it can be almost, well, I think it wears people out too. So it's in a
That's
way those communities are hard to sustain,
yes.
but there are, for a limited time, it can be really, really, really uniting. So why don't you just proceed then with your narrative of going up? Because by this at this point, you're really out of the church and you're really on your journey as a gay man.
Right.
And you talked about your religious experience, but why don't you tell us about how things evolved as a gay person?
So, Ann Arbor, it was a great town to be gay, but on the other hand, the population is still pretty small. It's a college town. It has 120,000 people or something in it, and so doing down the math, the gay population is fairly small. What I kind of did, I decide. I also am not I. I'm not a dancer. I'm not a kind of a guy who likes dance clubs much. And so so then my next couple years in grad school, this was all before, again, all of the kind of social media or any other ways that people connect now. So they're pretty much the way that gay people connected at this in this era is at the bar. And so that was your choice, and that was I kind of decided that I didn't like that choice. So for the next few years, what I really did was focused. I decided, look, what I'm going to do is focus on my academic work. So I was in graduate school studying medieval European history, and so I wanted to, focus on my study, my research, my writing. But in so doing, what I then found was kind of a tendency to fall back on this a habit, like you were talking about. In other words, making this pattern, which is, even though now I know I'm gay and I'm out and everything like that, I have some good straight male friends who, I start to, form some crushes on a little bit. And so when I started seeing myself like twice, kind of fall into that habit of really, obsessing a little bit too much about, this good friend of mine, and now no understanding that process so much more, then I said, well, I clearly this is a need or a lack in my life. I can't simply say I'm not worried about love and companionship and everything like that. Now I'm working on studies, and I'll worry about that late, this other aspect of my life later. I can't simply divorce my life from that. And so what I did was, in 1995, I did this kind of commitment. And 95 is I kind of consider like my dating year. And so I made this commitment that every single week, I would go to the bar on Friday, and that I would have to, in going there, I would have to, at least talk to at least one person, or meet one person, or ask somebody out, right? And that, and then, of course, if I actually started going out with them and then we were dating, then I didn't have to go anymore, right? But otherwise, if we weren't dating anymore, then I had to go back and go to the bar as part of this kind of commitment. And so I kind of forced
You're a
myself.
really good Mormon. That just sounds like a really Mormon way to go about
Approach it, huh?
dating.
Yeah, exactly. So
Go
there
to the
was.
singles ward, ask out one girl.
You have a list of rules of exactly how you've got to follow it. And so I was doing that, very, very much so. And so then I've dated more people that year than the rest of my life, connected, all put together. And so then I would, but what ended up happening then? Okay, so in the course of that year, what I found was, so then this was really the first serious dating that I'd actually done. I'd done a little bit at BYU, but not much. That was very, very serious at all. And so this was my first year of actual serious dating ever either. And then, but for me, it was always very quickly too serious, because I'm also, like you're suggesting, being way too much like a good Mormon boy who is on every one of these dates interviewing somebody for marriage, where I'm, sizing the person up instantly to, be my eternal companion, essentially. And then putting an awful lot of pressure on then those dates, and the other and the and any relationship that starts to form, because when I would find somebody then who I like did my internal math, my internal calculus, and said, well, he has all of these wonderful qualities, he it fits in, in these all the circumstances, I go through all the check marks and more or less say, yes, okay, this is we've got a match here, a person who is perfectly qualified to be my eternal companion. Well, at that point then, my seriousness or pressure on the relationship, just subconsciously, or anything that I might have been doing, or the thing that I would have been, doing, pressuring, and the desire or whatever, would have gone up so much that, it has been intolerable for the other person. And so, two, three, four guys in the course of 95 kind of had that kind of awful experience with me. And then a little bit later, years, then I finally did have a relationship with somebody who was another graduate student who's a extremely talented the next year who was a really extremely talented musician. We were just in really very he was exactly, I mean, what I was attracted to physically, and we were intensely physically compatible. He was also a genius, but we actually were bizarrely very not mentally compatible. But the numbers were close enough that, you know, that it was kind of that was working out for a while. Ultimately we though, well, ultimately he broke up with me. And he actually went on to being, I think he's first chair of in his instrument at the San Francisco Philharmonic. So he's a very talented musician. But anyway, my for me, his part of the problem was, for me, his first passion and love was for his music, and he was going to prioritize that above relationship or anything else. And obviously, I was still obsessed with, you know, putting relationship first on the one hand, and then on the other hand, I'm also actually a person. I'm about as unmusical as can be, and so I was kind of making a reasonable stab at being a symphony performer's spouse at the cocktail parties and things like that after a concert and going to the concert, but it wasn't certainly wasn't something that I was interested in.
Yeah.
Very interest, that was our problem.
Okay. So you finished grad school, still a single man.
That's right. And
Okay.
so at that point I decided, so at that point I decided, so actually I was leaving graduate school. So what I decided, I didn't want to be a professor after all. I was going to go into, I had started going into publishing. And so I began working for the University of Michigan Press. I started illustrating books, creating maps for books, illustrating museums, history museums, did work for Smithsonian Press and other university presses. And so that's the direction I kind of went from there. And then I also had decided then that Ann Arbor was way too small for me to be able to, I mean, I'd done all of my targeted dating that I could do, and all of my little plans were not going to, we're not going to increase the size of this population that I was trying to choose from. There was only so many people that could qualify for what I was looking for inside it. And so that I just decided that I really had to move to California in order to find a big enough population, either in LA or San Francisco. And so it was in the course of leaving Ann Arbor, moving out from Ann Arbor, and moving on my way to California while I was in Minneapolis working on some museums that I was designing the exhibits for, that I met Mike. Soon Mike and I have been together ever since then. So that was in 97.
Okay, so you guys met and you've been together ever since.
Yes.
Okay, how many years has that been?
Well, 97 to the present, so
So we're
it's
going on,
16.
yeah. Okay, well, so you've been in a relationship now for 16 years, and so, you know, you've now lived a substantial part of your adult life, you know, sort of in a way settled down, done with your career, done with your finding a mate. So why don't we talk a little bit about, you know, you talked already about your professional journey, but why don't you sort of talk about what it's like to be a gay man, part of a sexual minority, how that has sort of shaped your worldview, shaped your philosophy, shaped your life decisions, and can we go forward from there?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think that it was helpful for me, for the way I approach the world, to, you know, to approach it as a gay man. You don't, as everyone knows, you don't choose to be gay. But on the other hand, I think it's something that I've profited by very well in terms of my thinking, and I wouldn't want it to be any other way. By having this, you know, disconnect with what the regular, you know, worldview, the regular common sense, and the way you're approaching life, by having this immediate disconnect where you're seeing this is something that is inside me is not like the stories that we're told that everything should be. That immediately helps you to, I think, question just a lot of regular norms, and to be able to look beyond them, look at what it maybe actually is important or how systems actually work.
Yeah.
And so in a lot of ways, it has completely informed then, my life, my life decisions, and where it allowed me to take, in many cases, the roads less traveled.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I've always found that being gay had opened my world to a lot of possibilities that I wasn't considering before that, and not just relating to my sexual orientation, relating to a lot of things.
And so that's like completely, informed like a lot of our life decisions in general. And so, we went through and we even did the kind of, fairly extreme example of deciding, all right, well, we could, when we were looking around, had gone back to Ann Arbor where we founded our own company. And, at a certain point we decided, well, this town really, we're not enjoying it. The town's too small for us. Our company is a computer related company. And so we ultimately are able to live anywhere we want. So after 2006, we sold off our office and we no longer had we had a virtual office after that time. And so we could spend the time traveling, which we kind of have done extensively. We've gone on road trips to every one of the states except Alaska, pretty much. And, one of the things that we did in going around everywhere was decide, well, we want to figure out a place where we want to really set down roots. And we had different qualities that we were looking for. And so one of the things that we decided was, well, we don't want ultimately to be part of the big suburban car culture. We don't want to just simply get in, wake up, get in our car, go to the gym so we can get on a treadmill. We want to be able to live in a urban environment with good transit. So we want to be able to live in a city where, we can primarily walk around. We live right in the downtown heart of a place. We want to live in a place that is extremely cosmopolitan. We want to live in a place that, has a lot of diversity. So by being in a minority, you grow to appreciate minorities. And so that's one of the reasons why, kind of having surveyed North America, we decided, okay, well, we really enjoy the city of Toronto. It's worth going through the entire process of immigration in order to, get across the border, move, set down roots. And so now we live, right downtown. And what is, what people may be surprised to know is the most diverse city in the world. So because of Canada's very progressive, or relatively compared to the U.S. anyway, immigration system.
Let me explain that a little. Canada has had this policy of allowing educated people to immigrate there,
right,
basically for a long time, and it's really brought a lot of the best brains in the world to Canada, and they have considered that an excellent boost to their economy. But it also has had this effect of making the big cities in Canada very, very multi-ethnic.
Right.
And we've discovered that in Montreal too. We've had a similar experience here where we really, really enjoyed the international multicultural mix that we find right around us.
Well, and so that's exactly, what our experience here is. And so, just in the local gay community, our friends, here in Toronto already, they are from pretty well every country in the world. And so, we have friends that are born in Hong Kong and Singapore and Sri Lanka and Bahrain and Trinidad and, Argentina, all of these different countries, and everyone's here and they all, are completely fluent in English and they all have graduate degrees and that kind of thing. So it's, like you say, Canada has done the math and decided, hey, you know what, if we just let people with graduate degrees who are, have, skills where you could be doing, they could be creating important jobs. If we just let them move here, we don't have to have paid all of the money that it took to, educate somebody up to, a graduate degree level, which
right.
is just, countries that are losing people like that, like the U.S., let's say, it's an incredible expense that people don't tend to think about. They tend to, in the U.S., immigration is all about whether or not you are afraid that lots of Mexicans are going to move into the U.S. That's just
right.
a completely different mental, equation that people who are worried about immigration in the U.S. have. So,
yeah. Although, unfortunately, Canada's took a little bit of a turn for more restrictive immigration. But
well, we may, we'll see. I'm getting interested in Canadian politics too. So,
So being gay has been a big advantage to you and me as far as helping us see the world as a much bigger place with a lot more possibilities? And has that also influenced your politics, your life philosophy, your spiritual journey?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm sure it has. So I would say, politically, what we've seen in our lifetime is just not, for the LGBT community is nothing short of astounding. So that where things were when I was born in 1970, where as minority or a group of minorities, the people just faced, just terrible oppression, no legal rights, and just any kind of discrimination was not only tolerated, but just part of what the society wanted and encouraged. To go from that, state in North America here to, where we are now, we're in the wake of even an extremely conservative U.S. Supreme Court having just struck down the Defense of Marriage Act as unconstitutional, and also having eliminated the Prop 8.
Right.
That just wouldn't have been, even at the midpoint of that journey, was still seemingly impossible. So when I came out, in the early 90s, there was just no way that we would have conceived that we would have gotten here.
Right. Yeah, I never imagined in my life that we would have marriage equality. It didn't exist anywhere in the world until the early part of the century. So it just wasn't on our radar at all. We were just hoping for someday to get civil unions, right, or domestic partnership.
Politically at the time, I even thought, people that were even talking about it, I just thought, guys, we got some more base level priorities here that we need to, that we should be dealing with, which is like, people just not being able to have, people being able to legally discriminate in housing. They can, if you say, find out if someone, a landlord finds out you're gay, they can kick you out legally, or, in just in employment, if your boss finds out you're gay, they can just fire you for being gay, and I thought, okay, let's get to do some basic, bread and butter basics here and not, go for the whole pie in the sky thing. But actually, yeah. The pie in the sky ended up being good strategy in the end. So it's something that's something I didn't anticipate.
Yeah. But
what the thing I did think was fantastic, and actually the whole linchpin or engine of this whole process has been, the coming out strategy. And so, it was incredibly hard, and it just was just produce an intense amount of pain and problems for the original pioneers, who in the generation preceding me made sacrifices to come out.
Yeah.
That allowed for, when I actually came out, it made it for me, to be a relatively painless process. So it was not something that caused a lot of trauma for me. I've never actually had to suffer employment discrimination or any other thing, because of that, to now, to where things are now, where in a lot of places in society, it's not even, people are beyond, being, the discrimination, to the point where people are, a majority are in disagreement that we shouldn't discriminate and that people who are in love should be allowed to get married, and that's just the way it is. So.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the discrimination has almost disappeared in places like Toronto and Montreal.
Right.
Where, and the happiness scales of gay men have skyrocketed in those places where they're not suffering homophobia.
Right.
And to the point where a study in Montreal recently shows that gay men actually have higher happiness and higher mental health scores than straight men. So it just goes to show that we can do really well when the homophobia is removed. And it's not 100% removed anywhere, but much better there. And unfortunately, we're dealing with I'm dealing with a segment of society where the homophobia is really, really high, which is the Mormon community.
Right.
So they're still in the 50s and the 40s on that. But there's a little ray of light with a few people, or actually a lot of people, but I guess a small percentage of Mormons who are really becoming allies and really understand the issue and are really fighting. And so it's an amazing battle going on right now. But yeah, in the general Mormon society, it's still kind of in the Dark Ages in that way.
Yeah, right. So you're exactly right to remind us that we can't just sit here in our happiness enclaves
Right.
and you know celebrate the battle being won, while so many people are suffering in you know outside of the of those enclaves. And of course the work you're doing in helping in trying to help you know especially. The community that is, let's say, young people who are coming out still in Utah, and they're coming out at such a much earlier age than when I had to come out. When I came out, I was beyond when I was having a spiritual crisis about it. I was already, you know, on my own. So if my family had decided, you know, which they didn't, if my family had decided to, you know, cut me off or be horribly unsupportive or any such thing, well, I didn't. I was already. You know, living, you know, a whole many, many states away from them. And I would have just been able to, it would have been, you know, bad, but it wouldn't have killed me.
Right.
Whereas for, you know, kids who are 12 and 13 and who are facing their entire family support structure and their entire social network through their church and then their entire spiritual worldview and identity are all, you know, again, jostled in crisis all at once, that obviously still has the potential to be just horrifically devastating to people. So being just promoting awareness, helping young people like that or older people even who are just coming to terms with it in those environments is critically important to do and to tell people, look, this isn't the only way to view the world. You may well think that it may well be that everybody in your immediate community, your previous support network, views the world that way, and they may not be supportive of you at all. But that doesn't mean that you are trapped in that little reality, and that little reality is the whole of reality. You always are going to have more options, and there's lots of options outside of that. And hopefully, what we're doing here is helping people just see that little glimmer of what's going on outside.
Yeah. Well, I also want to give you a chance to soapbox a little bit about the Community of Christ, which used to be the Reorganized LDS Church. I know a lot of Mormons are averse, a lot of former Mormons are averse to proselyting. When people leave Mormonism, a lot of them just don't want to join any other church, right? But I think that people should consider lots of options, and you've found a lot of reasons to participate in a religious community, and one that felt good for you was the Community of Christ. Why don't you tell people, you explained already in your other podcast, but tell, at least from the perspective of a gay man, why the Community of Christ was attractive to you.
So part of what's going, for me, part of this whole idea of spreading the word about this isn't, I don't even consider this to be it, you know, this is not personal proselyting in any way, where what the community is doing for me is something that I personally even desperately need. I actually had lived a very fine and fulfilling and regular life outside of churches or outside of organized religion, which was very fine. But there are a whole bunch of people who are in conservative religions, especially in a religion like the LDS Church, who are facing kind of like a faith crisis like this, who for whom it isn't simply the best strategy isn't necessarily to simply reject religion altogether. In a lot of ways, the progressive denominations, for example, let's say in the Prop 8 battle, although initially the progressive churches were so much smaller, they were still less helpful than what the Catholics and the LDS Church were able to do. Some of the best allies in the Prop 8 battle in fighting against what the Catholics and the LDS Church were doing would have been the Episcopalian Church and Community of Christ. In other words, smaller churches that are saying, no, this issue isn't, we're not saying that, you know, God is here all about intolerance. God is on the side of hate, and God hates gay people, or at least they're saying they hate sin or whatever they want to call it. But anyway, rather what we can say is that this is not, we can't let fundamentalists or we can't let the rigid conservative literalists define faith for all people. So for people who would like, let's say, if a person doesn't have their whole life to devote to personal study of philosophy, if they are they're like a regular person who has to spend life working and raising a family, but they've decided, well, I would really like to, I like the ward experience that I had. I don't like what the leadership is telling me I'm supposed to kind of literally rigidly believe about what the leaders, the communication that they may well, they're claiming that they're having with very anthropomorphic God, or the things that they're saying have to be rigidly believed about where the Book of Abraham or the Book of Mormon came from. But what I did enjoy was the community that I had from my ward experience, and I do think it provided a good environment for me growing up as a way to, let's say, have instilled, some good work values and this kind of thing in my life. I would like, now that I'm like a mom or a dad who is just starting to have kids who are, 2 and 3 and whatever, and they're thinking, well, I'd like to be able to go to a church, Well, so for people like that, if we cede all of the ground to people who want to interpret God and the entire inheritance of religion, the entire field of spirituality, if we to the people who are sort of these reactionary literalists who have this view of religion that is actually a very modern new view, that is a reaction against the Enlightenment, a reaction against scientific understanding that we've had since the 16th and 17th and 18th century. This modern kind of rejectionist literalist conception of religion, if we concede the entire field to them, then everybody who does have that kind of innocent desire to want to be part of a good spiritual community, for raising their family or their kids, they don't have any option at all. So instead, I think it's really vital to, have an alternative option. And I think especially what's wonderful here in the with Community of Christ is within the Restoration, within the same tradition that comes out of Joseph Smith. I mean, we come back down to a Community of Christ. I mean, as a church, Community of Christ has Joseph Smith's bones. We have his house in Nauvoo. We have the Book of Mormon manuscript, the first temple itself. So in other words, this isn't some modern thing where I've just created, the gay Mormon church or something like that as a brand new thing that doesn't have any kind of legitimacy or whatever. That I'm not saying that people could make one and it wouldn't be just fine, but it doesn't have this level of experience that this comes from all the way back to the beginning from the same source.
And if
So,
you're attached to the idea of the tradition and the
right.
heritage, the Community of
Exactly.
Christ does share certainly a heritage with the LDS Church.
So you're part of the same faith tradition, but it has gone in a radically different path where the church experience is just entirely night and day different. From the LDS church experience, in terms of instead of being in very extremely leader focused and focused on, what the leaders say is the what the thinking is done, or that the way you would even give talks in church, or giving talks on what the talks the leaders have given, these kind of, everything is just intensely focused on leaders and leaders' authority and this kind of thing. Instead, having a religion that is very focused on, personal inspiration, that is focused on where the church is operated instead of by fiat, but by the common consent of the membership, where general conference isn't about simply raising your hands to sustain. It's rather about everybody being inspired by God, by everybody functioning not as God's dictatorship or theocracy on earth, but rather the commonwealth of God on earth, where every congregation sent, and mission center sends delegates to the conference, which in turn are inspired, voting together to decide what is scripture, and just voting together to decide what policies will govern the church. And so in that, for example, way, the church, rather than just simply waiting for fiat from the leaders in the most recent changes the church has gone through, the church had a, denomination-wide discernment process, which means everybody praying about it, thinking about it, coming together in a world conference where the prophet's counsel to, the conference ended up being canonized by the people as DNC 164, which ended up producing a system where each individual nation of the church can decide on how to deal with LGBT people. So this DNC 164 calls on the church by nation, by country, to have national conferences of the church where the people together will determine what's going on, how to address, this kind of vexing bad issue that's vexing all churches and actually all society that, is being dealt with in the courts. And so, for example, in Canada, the Community of Christ Met Together had its national conference last year and voted very overwhelmingly to not have any priesthood discrimination based on LGBT issues, and also to affirm that same-sex marriage, that marriage equality is the same as other marriage, and that priesthood holders can perform same-sex marriages in church. And that also then happened this year in the U.S. National Conference.
Okay. And so it's a nation by nation phenomena, but so far the three nations with the largest populations of Community of Christ members has now decided to affirm gay marriages.
Right. The reason why it was done that way, I think, instead of, and I think that was the right decision, as opposed to just pushing it forward denominationally, is that the church exists not only in Canada and the US and Australia, which have had their conferences, but it also exists in nations like Uganda. Right. And so Uganda, gay people are working on, facing whether the government of Uganda is pushing through laws that execute you for being gay.
Right.
Uganda has laws on the books that if you, as a church, affirm gay marriage, I think, as a principle of the church denomination wide, you are a criminal organization in Uganda and you're barred from being in Uganda. So
Right.
the church is pushing and wanting to push forward everybody to understand that discrimination is actually the thing that is most inimical to the Christian message, that the actual Christian message is love thy neighbor as thyself. That, the Jesus's message is gospel is the gospel of inclusion and love,
Yeah.
gospel of exclusion, hate, and discrimination. But it is obviously it's something that, not everybody in the world is all on the same page with this yet. So.
Right. Well, so it was a way of bringing the issue more gradually, which has a cost, but it has a benefit of producing less schisms within the church. And we are seeing this happening in the Anglican Church.
Right.
And it's happening in a different way with the Catholic Church, where the Catholics in Western Europe and the United States no longer, really believe in Catholicism. They're still Catholics, but they have rejected sort of the basic beliefs of Catholicism. And meanwhile, the highly conservative countries. So, in a sense, even though there's not an overt schism in Catholicism, there is this phenomena that they're, that
Oh, yeah.
they're not managing too well, I would say, but they're certainly dealing with. So,
Yep. Yeah. And so I
okay.
think that part of our church's discernment process was looking at, other examples and also looking at our own example. When Community of Christ ended, what was then called the RLDS Church, when it ended, the priesthood discrimination on the basis of gender, it really did cause a lot of people in 1985 to decide, well, this is. The church is now false. I'm leaving this church. And a lot of those people formed their own kind of schismatic RLDS churches. And even though now it's been, 30 years or so, and at this point or other, it's hard to, for it, let's say, if you're a kid or a grandkid whose parents or grandparents broke with the church, on holding the line over they want to discriminate against women. Well, it's hard to hold your head up proud and say that, right? If you broke from the LDS Church in 1978 because you said, "Well, I just can't let black people be ordained." Well, you're not going to be holding your head too high for making that decision now,
Right.
right? But it does freeze people in it. So if you did leave for that, then you get stuck there. And most of those people probably would be just fine with women's ordination now if they hadn't had taken that stand.
Yeah, so by taking the stance, by forcing them to take the stance, it had the end result of making them stick with that stance longer.
Right. And so in fact, actually, in the Community of Christ, I actually and I say this with, okay, I have acknowledging people who were raised in the church who were gay, who underwent a lot of suffering and for whom the delay was painful, right? So with
Yes.
that understanding and understanding that asking any individual to suffer for to and sacrifice, for any other maybe other good, the greater good of having some personal pain ultimately was that more people had their hearts opened, and more pe and there was very little or no schism as a result of these recent changes in Community of Christ. So by waiting and waiting maybe too long and spending a lot of what seemed like it was going to be too long anyway, by waiting a whole long time and then doing this thing in a little bit even more piecemeal way, nation by nation now, it allowed people who otherwise would have been lost to ever being open to this, have instead had their hearts open to this.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, thanks for, educating us on that and the current stance of the Community of Christ. So let's just tie this up then, and I'd like to give you a chance to see if there's anything else you want to add, say to the audience about any of these issues or.
I mean, I just really appreciate the work that you're doing with this podcast. I think that it's just critically important for us to be able to give people, especially people struggling in people who are gay, this community, just perspective that other ideas, other options, other ways of looking at the world, even other faiths that nevertheless still honor our same shared restoration heritage. There are other options that are available to people. So,
Yeah.
and I, if the people, if anybody, if this resonates with anybody, and they would like to talk to me, I'm always available on Facebook. You can just type in John Hamer and find me. And then I also have a Facebook group called Latter-day Seekers, where, we can talk about issues like this. But I'll also follow your thread on Gay Mormon Stories, and so and be available for questions.
Okie doke. Well, thank you very much, John, and I'm looking forward to hang out sometime in Toronto or Montreal if you make your way up here.
Yeah. Well,
You
we'll
ought to
come
come
visit
up.
you, and I hopefully you'll come visit us when you're down here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, very good then. Over and out.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Clayton Pixton. Check him out at claytonpixton.com. Why should this anxious load press down your weary mind? Haste to your heavenly Father's throne and sweet refreshment find. Thank you.
His goodness stands approved, unchanged from day to day. I'll drive.